It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
One. In a matter of hours, FBI Director Christopher Wray is set to testify before Congress on the increasing terror threat to America. Is this in an effort to save Americans or to save spying on Americans? Two, Dexter Reed shot 96 times by police officers. Let's discuss the story raging across the internet with the author of From Black Victims to Black Victors. And three, will Caitlin Clark take the ratings with her from women's college basketball to the WNBA? It is the Will Cain Show, streaming live at foxnews.com, on the Fox News YouTube channel, the Fox News Facebook page, and always on demand at Apple or on Spotify. Just hit subscribe to listen to the podcast or watch the Will Cain Show anytime you like, in whole or in shorts and exclusive interviews, in part by subscribing to the Will Cain Show, a button of which is right in the text description under this live stream. O.J. Simpson, dead from cancer at the age of 76. He finally did it. O.J. Simpson caught the killer of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Perlman. After the famous murder trial in the 1990s, in which O.J. Simpson was acquitted, he promised to spend every waking moment searching the golf courses of America for the perpetrator of that double murder. It took him several decades, but it looks like cancer and O.J. finally found the killer. O.J. Simpson is a fascinating figure, at least for people, I think, my age, for Generation X. O.J. represents the beginning of America placing the character above the plot, of placing social justice above the facts, of placing race above justice. And it's an interesting position for O.J. Simpson because for older generations, O.J. Simpson represents not just one of the best running backs of all time in the NFL, but if you ever watched the ESPN huge documentary on O.J. Simpson, what you also would understand is O.J. Simpson actually, in the beginning, represented a post-racial America. There's fascinating moments that reveal the O.J. of the 70s and the early 80s, that O.J. didn't want to be, you know, the famous black athlete, the most famous black athlete in America. He didn't want to stand on a stage with Jim Brown and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and make a big point of social justice. But in doing so, maybe even pursuing selfish goals of capitalism, of making money, O.J. broke barriers that just simply weren't broken before in America. He appeared in commercials for toothpaste. He appeared in commercials for Hertz Rent-A-Car. He was doing things and shifting the culture in a way that did move America towards real justice, towards post-racial America, which makes it all the more ironic that come the 1990s, he represents, I think, the beginning of a shift, at least for Generation X, of seeing that justice is always put second, or often put second, to race. What began with O.J. metastasized into Michael Brown. It metastasized into Jacob Blake. It metastasized into social justice and eventually DEI. It metastasized into identity politics and Black Lives Matter. O.J., of course, was happy to lean in to a jury and a city, for that matter, a country that happily set aside justice. Ask anyone today, ask Black America today, and they'll laugh about the idea that O.J. Simpson was innocent. But in the 1990s, it divided us between black and white in the face of ridiculous facts that, of course, everything pointed to O.J. being guilty. But in the 1990s, that case was treated, if not in the media, in the jury box, in the same way that we now treat ridiculous stories like the one floating around today about Dexter Reed. Dexter Reed, a man who was shot 96 times by police officers, and that's what the headlines will scream in the Washington Post, at CNN. But they'll leave out the detail that the first shot that was fired was from Dexter Reed. We're going to talk about that a little bit later here on the Will Cain Show with the author of From Black Victim to Black Victor. It'll be a fascinating conversation. And we will hope that somewhere in that conversation, somewhere in the context of the Will Cain Show, we will find some solution to the increasing pessimistic direction of America. Yesterday here, by the way, Dr. Arthur Herman said that not only me, but my co-host on Fox and Friends Weekend represent real optimism for America. Or actually, he didn't say my co-host on Fox and Friends Weekend. He said, I do, Will Cain. He said, Rachel Campos Duffy. And weirdly, he also said, this guy, who I think I know who he means, is a real hero for America.
I think we're about to see the rise of the next great generation for America. It's taking place now. I think you're going to be part of that. I think Phil Hegseth is part of that next greatest generation.
Phil Hegseth, part of the next great generation of heroes to save America. Now, little did Dr. Herman know that there is a Phil Hegseth. It's not my Fox and Friends Weekend co-host. Of course, that is Pete Hegseth. But Pete has a brother named Phil, and we need to get him on the phone as soon as possible and let him know that he represents real hope for America. Not his brother holding down the airwaves at Fox, but Phil, the brother of Pete, hero for America. All right, coming up today, you want to stick around because we're going to ask the question, does Caitlin Clark take the ratings with her from women's college basketball to the WNBA? And again, we're going to talk to the author of From Black Victim to Black Victor. But first, let's talk about whether or not, in just a matter of hours, FBI Director Christopher Wray is looking to save Americans or looking to save spying on Americans. Story number one. As mentioned, just here in a couple of hours, right here on this Fox News YouTube channel, you'll be able to stream the testimony of FBI Director Christopher Wray, who will testify before Congress on the increasing threats to America. This testimony should bring together three stories. And by stories, what we often mean is symptoms of deeper problems in America. And these three stories, these three symptoms of problems in America collide with one another. We'll have us asking exactly what and how to address the threat to America. Here are the three stories and symptoms all coming together with this testimony that you'll watch here shortly by Christopher Wray. There is a concerning amount of activity that is not just hidden inside of Intel reports, but that will spill across your news streams of antipathy, of hostility, of actually a threat you must take seriously that you would have previously heard from the streets of Tehran being yelled from the streets of Dearborn, Michigan. Watch this from last night on Jesse Waters Primetime.
Pro-Hamas protesters chanted death to America at a Ramadan rally in Dearborn, Michigan.
El Monte America!
El Monte America!
El Monte America!
El Monte
America! El Monte America!
El Monte.
Not a great look. The mayor condemned it. The White House condemned it. But what about Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib? She reps Dearborn. Is she okay with her constituents chanting death to America? Fox Business correspondent Hillary Vaughn asked her. Watch.
Congresswoman Tlaib.
Fox News. I don't talk to Fox News.
At a rally in your district, people were chanting death to America. Do you condemn?
I do not talk to Fox News.
But do you condemn chants of death to America?
I don't talk to people that use racist tropes.
Death to America. Not going to condemn it. Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib. That, again, is something you would hear from the streets of Tehran, but you hear it instead on the streets of Dearborn, Michigan. Now, that represents a threat. By the way, this issue is, of course, tied to the conflict in Israel and Gaza, and we should make two points on this. First of all, this issue, Israel and Gaza, is tearing apart political constituencies on the left and on the right. We talk a lot about what's happening on the left. Joe Biden seems to be losing the Muslim American vote. You see people like Tlaib and others who can't simply condemn death to America? How does Joe Biden build a coalition? How does he get, although small, the important vote of Jewish Americans? But it's also having a similar effect on the right. You can feel this burgeoning. It's all over, for example, X. Israel in Gaza is absolutely tearing apart what was before reliable political constituencies. And the world isn't full of politics. The world should be full of ideas. But we can see right now there's a real strain on America over an issue happening in Israel. And that takes you to this, by the way. There's new suggestions that Iran is looking to directly now launch an attack on Israel, not use proxies, but to launch attacks directly on Israel. As this ramps up, what I expect we will hear from Ray is that domestic terror threats under the banner of not hiding death to America represent here at home a threat to Americans. The second story that ties into this testimony is quite obvious and something we've talked about a lot. We on the right, we on Fox News, we on The Will Cain Show. And that is our porous border. Month after month, we talk about the number of people on the terror watch list coming over our southern border. There is a sense of inevitability that all of this, this horrific treatment of the border by Joe Biden, will lead to some security risk right here in America. This is at the core. You have to enforce your border if you want to enforce your security. And I would expect that is something that we should hear today. I would hope that we hear from FBI Director Christopher Wray. But third is the issue that is also dividing the right. And this is the issue of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Is Christopher Wray testifying today because of real threats to Americans or that he is under threat of losing the ability to spy on Americans? The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, Section 702 in particular, was designed to detect threats originating overseas, foreign actors, connecting with domestic actors, to use electronic surveillance, digital surveillance, to identify these potential threats and stop them before they happen in Times Square or in Dearborn, Michigan. The problem is FISA has been abused, and every one of us know this, although it wasn't under Section 702, according to most congressmen who have voted in favor of at least moving this bill down to the floor of the Congress for a vote. Carter Page, working for the Trump administration, was surveilled improperly, which has now been admitted basically with insufficient evidence under the banner of FISA to spy on Donald Trump's campaign. Of course, the ridiculous idea that he was coordinating with Russia to subvert American democracy. FISA has been abused to surveil Americans, and not just Americans who are somehow connected to Islamic radicals, but Americans who now represent, according to the FBI, the biggest threat to the homeland, domestic terrorism, and MAGA. They've made that clear. They've testified before Congress. They've set their priorities. We see the FBI, and we have to listen to them in the same way we listen to as an Islamic radical saying death to America. We listen to the FBI saying, you know who's the biggest threat to America? The far right. And so if they're going to use that power, who are they going to use it against? It's not hard to connect the dots. It's not hard to look at history and say, Americans. Donald Trump posted on Truth Social last night, kill FISA. It's been used to spy on me and to spy on my campaign. It's also been used, for that matter, for anyone involved in January 6th. How can we trust the FBI? How can we trust FBI Director Christopher Wray? Even if we trust that there is, and this is the real catch-22, this is the real nexus of the problem, even if we trust the idea that our porous southern border and increasing Islamic radicalism here at home does actually represent a threat that needs to be surveilled appropriately under FISA. There's so many people, it's just hard to find the right voices to trust. I will tell you, Congressman Chip Roy, Congressman Thomas Massey are some of the voices that I'm interested in. They voted separately. This is a rules procedure vote just yesterday on FISA. Roy voted against, Massey voted for. Now, they both have made their position clear. You want to surveil Americans? Get a warrant. Why did they vote separately? Well, that's kind of boring and it's procedural. And Massey suggests it needs to go to the floor in order to get amendments to put protections in against Americans. They want to protect Americans. Massey tweeted out a thread that I think is fascinating. He said, many people have been misled. This is not a vote on FISA. This is a partisan procedural vote. Democrats always vote no. They did. And 19 Republicans voted with the Democrats to stop this from coming to the floor, including the warrant amendment to FISA. Many of us who are adamantly opposed to warrantless surveillance voted for the resolution, wanted to get recorded votes on warrants, and recognizing the speaker can otherwise suspend rules and bring anything to the floor without a resolution, like he did to the omnibus. Tactically, whether or not the 19 did the best thing is to be determined. They may have just stopped our only chance to have a vote on whether the government needs a warrant to spy on you. That vote might not have passed, but everyone would have had to go on the record to see. So in other words, we will see Democrats, Republicans, who don't believe you have to get a warrant to spy on Americans. I believe that Thomas Massie is a trusted voice on privacy, a trusted voice on freedom. I would love to have Congressman Massie jump on this program anytime to shed light, or for that matter, Congressman Chip Roy, where they may disagree, and to shed light on something I think is very complicated, because we do need to balance what is obviously a growing terrorist threat here at home with dealing with two agencies in the DOJ and the FBI that have earned our distrust. And instead of using those powers to keep us safe, have used those powers to spy on Americans. I would rather hear from Massie and Roy than I would from someone like Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. Did you see the video of Sheila Jackson Lee, Congresswoman from Houston, Texas, trying to put on her eclipse glasses? She was completely defeated by the glass. Couldn't get them on straight. But that wasn't even the most embarrassing part. Listen to her describing the eclipse and the moon.
Sometimes you need to take the opportunity just to come out and see a full moon is that complete rounded circle, which is made up mostly of gases. And that's why the question is why or how could we as humans live on the moon? Are the gases such that we could do that? The sun is a mighty powerful heat that is almost impossible to go near the sun.
So first of all, the moon is not made of gases. It's made of metals and rock. The sun is made of gases. She's tweeted out since, Republicans are jumping all over me. I clearly meant sun, not moon, when I was talking about something with gases. But wait a minute, Congresswoman, are you saying that we could live on the sun? This is the quality of people deciding whether or not there are real threats to Americans and the ones deciding whether or not the DOJ and the FBI should have the power to spy on Americans. This represents a threat to America. Let's talk about Dexter Reed, O.J. Simpson, for that matter, and the overarching way to take the black community in America from victimhood to victor with the author of From Black Victor to Black Victim to Black Victor, Adam Coleman, next on The Will Cain Show.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Dexter Reed shot 96 times by police officers, but he shot first. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about O.J. Simpson. Let's talk about From Black Victims to Black Victors with Adam Coleman. Next, here on The Will Cain Show, streaming live at foxnews.com and on Fox News YouTube channel. Hit subscribe wherever you are, and you'll never miss an episode. You want to hang out with us. Let's just hang every day and see if we can break down the problems here in America. Hit subscribe on YouTube, Apple, or Spotify. He is the author of Black Victims to Black Victors, a new book. His name is Adam Coleman, and he's here now on The Will Cain Show. What's up, Adam?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Good. So I was told that you've been hanging out here through the beginning of the show. You heard what I had to say about O.J. Simpson or Sheila Jackson Lee, for that matter, or FISA. I'm just curious if you had any reaction after listening to me there for a couple minutes. I always love to hear if anyone has a reaction or a disagreement with what I had to say.
Well, interesting enough, just before I jumped on here, the New York Post asked me to write a piece about O.J. Simpson and his life. So I'll give my quick take on it. I think O.J. Simpson is the American fall from grace. Someone who, like you said, signified a seemingly post-racial society, a society that was trying to move past the superficial. And O.J. Simpson, I think, genuinely wanted that. He didn't want to be seen as just a black man. He also didn't necessarily ignore that he was black, but he just didn't want that to be the focal point of his life. and he wanted to be adored by everybody. And for someone like him, who was, and I guess I underestimated because of my age, he was extremely popular and very well known. And for someone who's basically on the top of the mountain to fall so far down due to his own actions, because he did kill them, I think is an American tragedy. And I think that that situation, you know, sparked, you know, what we see now is the media harping over every crime situation, you know, the flourishing of in-court cameras and things of that nature. And I think we, I think that court case and that entire situation and the lives lost was overall a tragedy, not just for him, but for the entire country. Race became a motivating factor to cover any news story. Race became the driving force for political movements. Race became everything whenever it was necessary.
It's interesting you talk about OJ, and as I did at the beginning of the show, going from this guy who didn't want to be seen as primarily black. I don't think he rejected his racial identity, but he didn't want to use it as his primary identity. To then, through his court case, leaning into it for the benefits of victimhood. Instead of Nicole Brown Simpson or Ron Perlman being the victims in the case, it became O.J. Simpson the victim of racism in the LAPD. And what's interesting about that is not so much O.J. Simpson, because, you know, look, every human being is selfish to some degree. And if you're on trial for murder, you're going to play any card you can get to get off, right? But what began with OJ began a societal, really a trump card in anything of a victimhood. And I know that's what you've written about. And look, I think psychologically, Adam, victimhood is a cancer. Like anybody that takes the pill or any community that takes the pill, you've begun your slow demise. You've begun your own death. But what we saw after OJ was it wasn't just the defendant that takes on the cloak of victimhood, but the community behind the perpetrator or the center of the story. And so it wasn't so much, oh, Michael Brown's a victim. It's like Black America is the victim in every single one of these stories.
Right. And the one thing about the court case was that what they were trying to do was prove a conspiracy, right? Or at least present reasonable doubt about his involvement, because there potentially being some sort of conspiracy revolving around the LAPD. However, conspiracies don't work if there isn't a grain of truth. And that's the unfortunate part. There is a grain of truth as far as the unfair treatment that the LAPD showed towards Black Americans within LA, right? And that led to all different types of reforms. I think there's an acknowledgement by the LAPD that there were things that they were doing that were wrong. But it's the exploitation of it, right? It's the exaggeration of it that becomes the conspiracy. And that's what I think we saw from this particular court case, was that, yes, you know, the Rodney King situation, should those cops have been found guilty? Many people say yes. And so that type of animosity that built from that situation where they felt that justice wasn't served turned into animosity, turned into a conspiracy, turned into, well, every situation involving the LAPD must be corrupt. Rather than saying that there are corrupt aspects of the LAPD, but it does not mean that O.J. Simpson did not kill Nicole Brown Simpson. And forgive me, I forget the other gentleman's name.
Ron Perlman.
Right, Ron Perlman. So, you know, I think that's the problem that we're facing here. We have a lot of conspiracy theorists who are exploiting real pain, real issues, real suffering, and exaggerating it and using it for their particular cause so they can avoid accountability.
Well, and then what you see, and you fast forward 30 years, is not just used in one court case, one court of law, but it becomes the same exact narrative towards America, right? So is there a grain of truth? Yeah, there's more than a grain of truth that America has a really sordid history with race. But does that allow you to paint everything in America systemically racist in every situation as the product of racism? And so we have gone from simply saying, you know, OJ's innocent because the LAPD, there's a kernel of truth that the LAPD is imperfect or exhibits racism, to we've gone to, you know, black victimhood in all situations because America is systemically racist.
Right. That's the exaggeration piece. And when it comes to like a legit, I know we say conspiracy theorists and for anything and everything these days, but when I mean it in a genuine sense of like paranoia, right? And that's what I see often. It's that leap to paranoia that someone is always out to get us, right? And I'll speak for myself. You know, there was a period of time when it felt like, and this was years ago, but I remember hearing news story after news story of a black person shot by the police. And I remember I got pulled over around that time. And I remember shaking, even though I don't do drugs, I don't have any guns, I'm not doing anything illegal. I probably was just speeding a little bit like most people do. But I remember shaking. And why? And it's because the propaganda makes you paranoid. And that's what we really saw. And so that grain of truth just explodes into paranoia. And you end up living your life on the edge, worrying that you're going to be the next George Floyd, worrying that you're going to be the next victim of some sort of heinous act, when the reality is it's extremely rare. And see, that's the other end of it. When we're so paranoid that we can't recognize the progress, then we live these miserable lives in America, not realizing how good things are. And I think for me, what I'm trying to point out for a lot of people, whether they're black, white, or any other race, is that life is difficult. There are always going to be issues. There are always going to be problems. But what's amazing about our country is that there is grace. What is amazing about our country is that we have progressed. And I don't think we should ignore the progress. Just like focusing on the progress doesn't mean you ignore injustice, right? They're not mutually exclusive. So we should be able to talk about both. If there is a legitimate situation where a black person is mistreated, then we can talk about that. We can talk about it in a rational way, but we can also acknowledge that life has gotten much better for people who look like me.
I want to get into your book in just a moment. Adam Coleman, the author of From Black Victim to Black Victor, here on The Will Cain Show. I need to make a quick correction. Something when it came out of my mouth, and I realized it's come out of my mouth twice in the course of this show, said Ron Perlman. He's a far left actor. It's Ron Goldman, and my apologies for getting the second victim in the O.J. Simpson murders name wrong. It's Ron Goldman. You know, again, I want to get into the substance of your book, which I find fascinating. I want to make two quick points. I want to get your reaction to it. Just two things that are kind of on my mind. One of the things is, whenever you have this conversation, Adam, I think that, and I used to be on ESPN, and I will say that I used to have a bigger audience of black listeners, and I enjoyed that back and forth. That I know there are black people watching The Will Cain Show, and I know that because I hear from you. But even those more that disagreed with me, is when I go down these conversations, I'm often met with, why do you deny the existence of racism? And that's not what I'm doing. Okay. So, so I want to make two statements or two observations and get your reaction. One is, the constant perception, or as you described it, paranoia, that everything is racist, absolves people of their own personality. In other words, you know, you go through the world, right? And look, there are and there are polite people. There are people with bad personalities and people that are nice with good personalities. And if everything about you that is met with negativity you think is because someone else's racism, then you never have to ask yourself, hey, I wonder if I was being from polite. You know, in other words, it just robs every single person of their own individuality. And trust me, you know, however many shades of skin color out there, there are way more versions of personalities, you know. No. So I just think it's kind of this like get out of jail free thing on your own personality. But that doesn't deny the existence of racism. And then there's this, Adam, like, you know, my sons grew up in New York City playing soccer, and they were in a very diverse school and soccer program. Like, when I say diverse, it actually wasn't diverse. That was a euphemism. It was overwhelmingly black, and my sons were the minority. And I saw a story, it was just last week, and there's a big soccer tournament every year for academy-level soccer players. And this kid that I care a lot about, I've known him since he was a kid. Stories everywhere about New York Red Bulls players being racially abused on two separate occasions. For what it's worth, these were from other players, one from Monterey, a team from Monterey, another one from Croatia. And what the Red Bulls decided to do, Adam, was leave the tournament. They decided to leave the tournament. And this is a big thing in soccer. I don't know if you're a sports fan at all, but they're really trying to tackle racism. And, you know, you know, whether or not it's in the crowd or on the field, they're trying to tackle people. And I do wonder, I don't have an answer to this. Like, is walking away from these situations, dropping out of a tournament, does that actually end up solving what we would both acknowledge as a problem if these players are racially abused?
That's a very good question. And just to let you know, I'm a huge soccer or football fan. I watch it, and I've been to games out in Europe as well. So I'm very well aware, especially throughout Europe, the End Racism campaign. And right. I'm tied when it comes to this particular situation. Part of me says, I understand the need to protest, right? To say, you know what, this is not acceptable. But then part of me says that, are we not being resilient because we're just withdrawing ourselves and saying, and it, I don't know, I'm tied as well, because part of me wants to think that by staying in it doesn't necessarily mean you accept it. You can talk about it afterwards, but it means that you're willing to move forward and do things in spite of right. the existence of this happening. And, you know, I understand the importance of protests, but I'm not 100% sure that changes anything. I think showing that you are strong, showing that you're willing to deal with it and call it out, right? I think to me that says a lot about someone who's willing to go through that. And I've heard stories from Black players who played in England decades ago, and they experienced racial abuse and they don't deny it, right? And a lot of people don't deny it. They say those were rough days in England, but they still played. They still play for their club, and they did what they had to do. And, you know, I think that's still possible for you to accomplish. I don't think that keep playing means that you're okay with it. I think there are ways to address right. it, you know, and move forward.
And I also, look, I love this kid. I've known him since a kid. Like, I love this kid, and I hate that this happened to him, you know. I hate it happens to anybody. But I also then go, how do you make it stop? And you're a soccer fan. You may be a sports fan at large. I'm a sports fan. What, you know what an opponent's going to do? Anything they can to take you out of your game. And sure. You know, what's said on an American football field, I'm sure it would abhor the sensibilities of any, you know, average American. Now, do those players mean it or not? I don't know. That doesn't make it right or wrong. But I do probably suspect the motivation is, I'm going to try to get under his skin. I'm going to try to throw him off his game. And if he walks off the field, all the better. So in the purpose of like trying to actually solve it so this doesn't happen again, I'm not sure a protest of walking away is a step forward. It's like FIFA. I did this on the show a few weeks ago, getting mad at the Mexican fans for yelling what they call a homophobic slur. You know what I'm talking about? That mm-hmm. happens every time Mexico plays. You can give as many public announcements as you want and stop the game. You're not going to stop them by reprimanding them in the middle of a game.
Right. Right. And that's exactly it. And especially when you have a stadium filled with tens of thousands of people and one person says something and a goalkeeper overhears it, or one of the players overhears it, like, and that means that the entirety of it is guilty, you know. And also the other part of it is, while I understand wanting to bring it up when it does happen, and we talked about competitive edge, isn't there a competitive edge for exploiting a hypersensitive environment, right? Because all you have to do is say that it happened. I mean,
right. And oh, right.
Is anybody, like, let's say, for example, I'm a player and I say that I heard racial abuse, and they can go and listen to the tapes and listen back to the microphones and everything, and they don't hear anything. Are they going to be willing enough to say publicly that Adam is lying? No, but I could still possibly get this team in trouble. I could make this team worry about saying something to me next time, right? So there's a competitive edge as well in the exploitation of this particular issue as well.
All right, let's go back to the book now, Black Victims to Black Victors. Again, author Adam Coleman here on The Will Cain Show. You go through a lot of different concepts in the book that I think are fascinating on how to make that journey in the Black community from victimhood to victor. Let's talk about a couple of them. So I don't even understand, Adam, why this one becomes controversial. An old colleague of mine, Stephen A. Smith at ESPN, seems to think this is controversial. We see the stats on fatherlessness and masculinity, I mean, we've also seen the societal or the social experiments on what happens when you have a home. And again, I think what happens is people have a hard time reconciling broad statistics with anecdotal exceptions. So you know someone that grew up without a father and he's a great guy. That's great. That's awesome. But broadly, societally, if you have a community that doesn't have fathers, and what is it, Adam? Is it 75% of black households have a father who's not present? That's a recipe for a problem.
I think so. It's close to that. Yeah, you do have a problem. And the one thing that, listen, I detail in the book, I grew up without my father. I didn't go to jail. I don't have a criminal history. I never got into drugs or anything like that, right? But it does not mean that I would advocate for someone to grow up without a father, even though I turned out okay. There's a lot of things that happen in between that you just don't see that happens in someone's life. You know, I struggled with depression. I had thoughts of suicide multiple times throughout my life. I've been homeless as a child and as an adult. Like, there are all these different struggles that happen. And a lot of it has to do with the lack of male support. And I think that's, there's this gray area that we're not acknowledging. It's either your father is there and everything is great, or, well, you know, your father wasn't there, so, but you turned out fine. And they just kind of keep it moving. There's just so much that's in between. And not all of us go to jail. Not all of us are doing drugs. Not all of us are shooting people in the streets, right? Some of us really do struggle. Some of us take our own lives, not someone else's life. And I think these people matter who are like myself, because I'm just a couple of moments from doing that years ago. And I think this is the root of the problem. When we talk about people who end up in jail who are doing drugs, we're talking about the extremes. And it's like anything else. When you increase a population of people who are at high risk, then you increase the extremes of the high-risk population. That is what you're seeing. And on the flip side, part of the reason I wanted to talk about single parenthood is because really it's a commonality as an American problem, not just a black problem. See, it's the canary right in the coal mine for black Americans, but it's the entire situation when it comes to Americans, no matter what they look like. Nearly a quarter of children are growing up in separate homes in the United States from their parents. That is an American tragedy that's happening. And it's not just a black face, it is a white face also. It is a Hispanic face also. And while there's a disproportionate amount of black Americans who are growing up in separate homes from their parents, there are more white Americans who are growing up in separate homes from their parents, the black Americans. So the impact
more sheer
is there.
Numbers, but not more per capita, not more per population,
exactly,
to your point on disproportionate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep, you're exactly right. And when I talk about these things, let me tell you, overwhelmingly, the people who reach out to me and say, that's my story, do not look like me, right? And these are, for many white Americans, their story is being pushed under the rug because everybody wants to talk about our mess, when it really, it's an American
right
mess. We have an entire country we have to fix.
Yeah, you're talking about the fundamental societal building block, regardless of race,
exactly,
which is the family. When you get into these conversations, Adam, where you and I to have more disagreement, or, you know, somebody who advocates black or white for the existence of systemic racism, any of the problems that we'd be addressing, right? Fatherlessness, family structure, community, what would happen is the conversation would start going backwards. So instead of going forwards and looking solution oriented or looking for a victor, what would happen would be, well, why is it there are so many black fatherless families? And it would point to, you know, America's war on drugs or the increasing prison population, and then go back to systemic racism, you know, or, you know, if we were talking about, you know, net worth, it would go back to redline laws and ability to build family wealth through home ownership. So what I'm getting at is similar to where you were talking about with OJ, would there be a kernel of truth in all of those things? Yes. Yes, there would. But does it extrapolate into this larger conversation that just centers itself and never moves on from victimhood versus here's where we sit in the present, how do we move to victor?
Yeah, there is a kernel of truth when it comes to all of that. However, just like my upbringing wasn't the best upbringing, I'm still responsible for my life. And I think when you become accountable, right? And just so people understand, when I talk about Black victim to Black victor, we can say the Black community, but really I'm talking about myself as well. Because there are moments mm-hmm. in my life where I felt like the victim. I acted that way. And I struggled even more so because of that. But then there were moments when I finally overcame that, right? When I pushed forward and I was able to succeed. And it's that, you know, the willingness to do things in spite of your circumstance. And when I hear someone harping on what happened hundreds of years ago, and ignoring their actual responsibility for their behavior, their responsibility for their outcome, because I can talk about, like, okay, I get it, you're right, these bad things happen, but you didn't help, right? And before we start looking and pointing at other people, we need to actually point at ourselves and see where could we have done something better in that situation. So the book is also talking about me. I started taking the position of, no matter what I see, no matter what happens in my life, I ask myself, what could I have done better in that situation? If I got fired from a job, gosh, if I lost out on an opportunity, what could I have done better in that situation? And that is empowering. Something of strength.
Yeah. By the way, I'm not Black. I do the same thing, right? I think anybody that strives for success, okay, this thing happened. Is it all my fault? No. You know, like, circumstances or even victimhood. Maybe somebody did something that actually undercut me or hurt me, you know, career-wise or whatever it may be. But instead of sitting in that and wallowing in that, you have to move to, okay, but what could I have done better? How could I have seen it coming? Well, how could I have responded? Because that's empowering. That's like I'm looking down the road instead of stuck in place or looking backwards behind me down the road.
You're exactly right. And that's what I was doing for much of my life. I was looking behind me, right? I was talking about, I didn't have my father, and this is why. It's like, okay, yes, I didn't have my father in my life. But you know what? Now I am a father, right? And I have to look forward and raise my son to become a man. And I first had to figure out what it was to be a man. How do you become a man? What is a man? And had to teach these things to my son. And that's how I was able to actually grow up in many ways and overcome these struggles, because I saw the importance of me getting my life together for my son and having it figured out for my son and sacrificing for my son. So yeah, if you look in the past, you're not looking forward. And in many ways, when we keep looking in the past, we're letting our children down as well.
So what do you think is the role, or how do you explain, Adam? Let's take this example of this case that I don't know. It feels like there's a concerted effort to turn it into, I don't think it will take off because the facts are so, I don't know. I have to acknowledge the limitation of my own understanding of the facts, but I've read the stories. Always in these moments, you got to say to yourself, let's let the facts emerge. But Dexter Reed, Chicago, Illinois, apparently a shootout with police. The allegations are now that he fired first. He's pulled over. He has heavily tinted windows. He's wearing a ski mask. I think the pretext for the pullover is seatbelt. Legitimate question, how did the cops know he wasn't wearing a seatbelt if the windows were so tinted and couldn't see him? Regardless of the pretext of the pullover, apparently he shoots first. Cops respond with multiple officers, 96 total shots. He's dead. Here's the headlines in the Washington Post, CNN, and other places. You can take a look at some of the headlines. This is Washington Post. Police fire 96 shots in 41 seconds, killing Black man during traffic stop. It's the same, by the way, Adam, at USA Today and CNN. It doesn't say anything about him firing first. And it's almost like there's, you know, you and I are talking about how to personalize and understand your own place in your life. But then there's like this ecosystem around it. Like, what is going on? Like, what's going on with the Washington Post? What's going on with CNN? What's going on with the ecosystem that feeds this? No, no, no. Look, victim.
What's going on is that whether you like the story or hate the story, you're going to talk about them, right? And if they paint a certain picture that is false, the people who disagree with it are going to pay attention. And if they paint a picture that is misleadingly in favor of what you already believe, you're going to pay attention even more too. So what we're finding is that we have a dishonest media environment where everybody just sets out their most extreme interpretation of what's going on to elicit an emotion. And your emotion is going to make you click on the link or tune into their TV show or listen to their podcast series. Like, this is the environment that we're growing up in now. It is not the media environment of yesteryear. And honestly, and I say this as somebody who has an independent publication platform, we're seeing much of the same behavior coming from the independent outlets because many of them don't get corporate dollars. They need clickbait to survive, right? So everybody is being misled when it comes to the media. And I say this as someone who's involved in the media these days, is that it is not a left-right thing when it comes to media manipulation. It is bipartisan. And it's there's an economic driver when it comes to this as well. So people have to discern the information that's coming through. Does this make sense? Go to multiple sources. And if you're someone who just says the Washington Post is, oh, well, they're definitely telling me the truth. Well, then you're going to easily be misled because you need to check the entire thing. And honestly, people just need to use common sense. Where's the smell test, right? Where's the smell test when it comes to, do cops just shoot someone 90 times just cause? No, they don't. Even if it's they thought they saw a gun, there's usually some sort of pretext to an action. So what was the pretext? And if they withhold that the person shot at the police, assuming that this information is true, I'm not too familiar with this case, but assuming that information is true, well then, I don't know, my empathy for this person dying is not as strong as it would be if they were shot for no reason and were unarmed. So I think people just need to be more mindful of the source of information that you're taking in. Even if it tickles your bias, you need to start asking questions.
Even more so if it tickles your bias. You know, I think you're absolutely right. And I've kind of been resistant to the clickbait thing in the past because it felt like too easy of an answer. But, and I, look, I'm in the media, you know, but I do think that's, it's becoming more obvious that that's the motivational pull behind, and I think you're right, it's bipartisan, behind a lot of the stuff that we get. But I also like you saying, just use common sense. Doesn't pass the smell test. We all live lives. Like, does that make sense that that's how something would go? But don't stop there. Then investigate into both. Hey, where'd you grow up, Adam?
We moved a lot. I was born in Detroit, but I've lived in four states before the age of 18. But I tell people from New Jersey. I've lived in Jersey for 20 plus years.
Here's why I ask. One more on this idea of black victimhood to black victor. I saw this recently. So I told you that, you know, my sons, I'm happy to talk about, they went to Success Academy in Harlem, which is in New York City, which is a charter school, and it's overwhelmingly black. But especially in the world of soccer, the vast majority of people I were around was African-American. And when I say that, I mean the parents were immigrants from Africa. I was watching a clip, I think, from Shannon Sharpe's podcast. He's a former player in the NFL. And I can't remember the comedian that he had on. But the comedian was going after the African-American community. And I'm saying it this way to distinguish black American from African-American. And he was kind of talking about this divide, right, between the two communities. And I find it interesting. I find it interesting in so much as it sort of represents a cultural divide within black America. And so a lot of the things that you talk about in your book, you could argue are symptoms or problems that need to be resolved or moved beyond when it comes to black Americans that don't exist perhaps for immigrants from Africa.
That is true. And to fill in, that was Godfrey, the comedian.
Yeah. Yeah. You saw it too then. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So what do you think about that divide?
It's a fascinating divide. In the online world, there's the FBA, the Foundation of Black Americans, who tried to distinguish themselves from someone who might be Caribbean, from someone who might be from Africa. There is a very strange divide that happens there. I think there are certain Black Americans, obviously not most, but I think there are certain Black Americans who are envious. There's no other way of kind of seeing it. They are envious because they know, we could talk about the stats of wealth, progress, opportunities from people who come to this country with basically nothing, not even, and many times they come here without knowing the native language and excelling past, you know, if you were to say this in terms of groups, their group, right? Excelling past Black Americans statistically. And I think there is a bit of envy when it comes to that, right? So the idea that there is this inherent racism that is happening present day, but yet it is not affecting them, right? It smacks them in the face, because how is that the case, right? And that's when they go, well, historically, but I don't know. I get if
there's also cultural differences as well, right? There's cultural differences, Adam, like even within the home we're talking about, like with the fatherhood, many African immigrant families are intact family units.
Right.
And then, I even wonder about, look, I think culture is important, and I'm not rejecting rap. There's a lot of rap that I like, and, but like there's a lot of things that in culture that, like, if you wake up every day thinking negative thoughts and you're going to produce negative outcomes, I'm a big believer in that, right? And so if you listen to music all day long that has negativity or paints a negative picture or tells you certain things, I think you're going to manifest negativity. And so I just think there's some cultural divides there that is showing up beyond simply skin color.
Yeah, absolutely. And listen, there are third-party situations. There are third-party actors. If we talk about the music industry, God knows how many third-party non-Black Americans who are involved in rap music who are pushing degenerate music and make money off of it. So it's not to say that, hey, listen, there's no culpability for anybody else. But at the end of the day, we should be able to do in spite of. And I didn't grow up in a privileged life, and I was able to find some sort of way to do things in spite of my circumstance. And I think many Americans can do this, whether they're Black or white. They just have to believe they're able to. And I think we need stronger mentors. We need stronger parents. We need more parental involvement. We need less of the courts getting involved in parents' lives. You know, we need accountability to return. We need parents to have some balls in return. What's happening in the school systems and transing children, this is weak parents who are allowing it to happen. And as soon as I started seeing some of that strange stuff happening in my son's school, for one, I educated him so he could let me know if this happens, to let me know. And then I took him out of the school and I took control of his life and his education. And he's been happy since. So I think we need a return to, like you said, that culture. It's a culture of parenting that actually cares. It's a culture of parenting that says, I'm your parent, not your friend. And we have too many parents who want to be their children's friend. So I think there needs to be a lot of accountability, a lot of parents who do the hard work and make the hard decisions for the children, even if their children hate them at that moment, they're doing it for the best of them, because in the future, their kids are going to thank them.
Awesome stuff. Personal empowerment. Positive message from Black victim to Black victor. Adam Coleman, it's not from, it's just Black victim to Black victor. You guys should check it out. I mean, amazing message. And I appreciate you sharing it today here on The Will Cain Show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Again, check him out. Adam Coleman. All right. Women's college basketball national championship ratings through the roof. Blew the men's national championship away. But will that follow Caitlin Clark to the WNBA? That's next on The Will Cain Show. Clay Travis says that Caitlin Clark represents the Ronda Rousey effect, that right after she's gone, the ratings for women's college basketball will plummet. But will the ratings follow her to the WNBA? It's The Will Cain Show, streaming live at foxnews.com, on the Fox News YouTube channel and the Fox News Facebook page. Just hit subscribe at Apple, Spotify, or on YouTube, and hang out every day, noon Eastern, here on The Will Cain Show. Caitlin Clark, as we spoke about just a couple of days ago here on The Will Cain Show, was the episode with Dave Rubin. We talked about the backlash, the women supporting women effect of all the attacks on Caitlin Clark from stars within the WNBA. Well, Diana Taurasi's not done. This is what she had to say about Caitlin Clark in the WNBA.
You know, this country has a fascination with young female athletes, and then it goes away, which I don't understand. You know, whether it's the young gymnast, the young skateboarder, the young pitcher, and then it's like once you become a professional, it all goes away. But that's the pinnacle. If you're the best in the pros, then you're the best in the world. And I think people have to still remember that when it comes to women's sports.
Well, I mean, it's not hard to figure out why people are fascinated with young. You know, as we just talked about with Adam Coleman, I'm into soccer. It's not my number one sport, but It's getting up there. I mean, football is my number one sport, American football. And by the way, I was at the Texas Rangers game last night, World Series champion Texas Rangers. And the Mavs are hot, and the Stars are the best team in the NHL. So I love them all. But I was watching yesterday a little bit of Champions League soccer, and I was watching Barcelona versus Paris Saint-Germain. And Barcelona had two players, one 17 years old starting at center back. He was awesome. And then they have a 16-year-old, who's most people suggest is on the path to being one of the best players in the world, starting at wing. And of course, I'm fascinated with the fact there's a 16-year-old and a 17-year-old starting for Barcelona in the Champions League. Why wouldn't I be fascinated with youth? It's the outlier. That's what I talked about when it came to Caitlin Clark. You know, okay, is there some fascination with her because she's white? Yeah, I think so. Because it makes her less so in women's, but more so in the world of basketball, an outlier. Like Tiger Woods when he came to golf, an outlier. People are fascinated by, attracted, and drawn to outliers. So, of course, youth gets attention, whereas a player in their prime in the WNBA might not get the same kind of attention. Not might be. Doesn't get the same kind of attention. 18 million people watched Caitlin Clark in the Women's College Basketball National Championship game. And there are many saying, well, this is it. This is the arrival point for women's college basketball. No, it's not. I agree with Clay Travis. It's the Ronda Rousey effect. When she leaves, the ratings will come back down to earth. Now, will they go down to as low as they were before? I don't know. There'll be some residual effect, maybe. But the ratings will come back down to earth because this was about the outlier. It's about Caitlin Clark. But here's what I think is fascinating. Will the ratings follow her into the WNBA if she's that big a star? Will she also bring the same kind of ratings effect to the Chicago Sky or whoever? It's the Indiana something that has the number one pick in the WNBA draft. And the answer I think we know is also no. There may be some small ratings boost, but they won't carry over to pro. And, you know, Diana Taurasi can wonder why, but it doesn't have so much to do with society. Is it just, and the way they treat women athletes, it has to do with people like college basketball, specifically women's college basketball. It's one of the few sports where you could go, the college version of it is more popular than the pro. And why? Because it has a built-in community. You know, the people of Iowa rally around the Lady Hawkeyes. The people of Connecticut rally around the UConn women's basketball team. Do they watch the Connecticut Sun, which Two-a-days Dan told me today that's the name of the WNBA team in Connecticut because they play at Mohegan Sun. I didn't even know the name of it. And the answer is no, they don't rally around the Connecticut Sun. Why? Schools represent community. I know guys that watch Baylor Bears, Lady Bears basketball. I'm not into it, even though the Longhorns are pretty good at women's basketball. Just never added it to my list of sports that I pay deep attention to. It's just one of those sports. It was pointed out lacrosse is another one. Popular in college, nobody cares about professional lacrosse. And there's not very many where the collegiate version is more popular than the pro, but that's the case of women's college basketball, and I don't expect it to change with Caitlin Clark. Will they get a bump? Maybe. Will they see those same kind of gangbusters ratings for the WNBA? No. And will women's college basketball continue to have gangbusters ratings without Caitlin Clark? No. All right, that's going to do it for me today here on The Will Cain Show. Monday through Thursday, 12 o'clock Eastern, live tomorrow, sports exclusive version of The Will Cain Show, and I will see you again live on Monday. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcast and Amazon Prime members. You can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.